Good evening. I want to introduce to you my friend Claire, who is also my ex-distant cousin-in-law, I guess you could say, who's come all the way from Bloomington, Indiana, and is visiting me. I'm really happy to have you here tonight.
Thank you.
Yeah. Let's introduce around.
I'm Donna Lynn. You too. Sally.
Bob.
Ron.
Samia.
Britt.
Wendy.
Kiseo.
Claire.
So Donna Lynn and I are just back from Empty Nest. The SPOT program had a 3-day study of funeral rituals, very interesting, in which we got to, or they got to play act different roles and to see how you could put together a funeral when nobody agreed with anybody. So you had members of the family on one side and members of the people in the zendo who would be running the, doing the bells and doing the ceremony, and there was immediately, there was jockeying for who got to be in the procession and who got to stand where in the procession. It was so funny. Just all these things came up and people began to believe their own parts, and the really difficult one, everybody was given a secret person to be. And then, and an attitude to take. And some of them were very nice, and some of them were grieving, and some of them were very stubborn and wanted it just their way. So, and nobody knew the other ones what their little part was. They just had to play it and see it when it happened. And pretty soon, people were really mad at each other, and then they felt so bad, and they thought, "Oh, I hardly know you," and now I'm. But it was very interesting to see how a funeral, a very simple, all our ceremonies, all our rituals are so simple, as we just did, so plain. And with those simple elements, how nicely it can be worked into any kind of situation. So each little group made up a situation, and on one the best friend of the person who died wanted to put a baseball mitt on the altar. And there was some thought, and well, why not? You know, you can just... And working together with the situation itself rather than just imposing a pattern down on a situation and trying to fit people into it. It was a matter of working together with people. And if people didn't agree, then the leader would say, well, we'll put that off and we'll talk about it another time. We'll talk about it tomorrow. And just let things unfold in their own way. There was so much learning in all of that. And so I, who was on the other side, just trying to hold this the group together in the space, I was sitting there with big eyes, just soaking it all in and thinking, well, I can share this for the rest of my life. It will be very, very helpful. So I think this SPOT program is going to be helpful to all of us in some way. It's a great honor for me. Ron?
Can you explain what is the SPOT program?
Well, I don't even know what SPOT stands for exactly. But it's a priest training program. You know, in the conventional way in Zen, you are ordained as a priest, and then you are hooked to your teacher for 2 or 3 years. And the teacher has this formula of running you through all the different ways of doing things. So this is how you do at the altar, and this is how you offer the incense, and all of that. But it leaves the whole human element out of it. And so Grace Shireson and Steve Stuckey, who is the, he's Zen Center's, the head of Zen Center at this point, or one of them. And Lou Richard.
You're still tired.
I am still tired. I am. But the three of them, and now me, are running these occasional programs, mostly up at Grace's ranch, up in the foothills of the Sierras, where at the moment it's green grass and beautiful trees, four different kinds of oak trees, and in between the blooming of red buds. If you know what red buds are, they're small trees that just suddenly burst into this amazing color that there isn't even a name for. It's so beautiful. And then in the far distance, the snowy peaks of Yosemite. So it's a marvelous place. That's where we go in the summer for the women's writing retreat. So that's what it is. And I'm in it because Darlene Cohen died, and she suggested that I try out for it. And so this has been the third time, and I guess I passed. So we'll do another one in June, another one in August, another one in October, I think. So all through the year we get together. 32 people are involved in the program. So it's very, very interesting people, really wonderful people.
It's a three-year program.
Yeah, three-year program.
It's their second series. Just a little clarification, I'm not in the program, but I get to accompany Angie. Someone's invited to come with Angie. So when they were doing all this role-playing, I'd see them come out, and they were like, or, you know, or apologizing for all these things. And so it's very fun to watch these people. It's really a fabulous group of people coming from all over. Somebody even comes from Texas,
I think. Yeah, I think so.
But all just very, it's just really wonderful to be around these people that have really taken this way of being and practicing instead of lifestyle and going out into the world. It's really, it's really privileged to be around.
That's the other point, of course, of the program is that in the old Zen tradition, you trained in a monastery, and then you went back to Daddy's temple, and you took care of Daddy's temple for the rest of your life, and tried to have a son who could inherit the temple, who could then blah, blah, blah. But in our practice here in the West, we're not in a temple. We're not even training in a temple. We're all living a lay life. And so the people who ordain maybe practice at Tassajara for a while, or someplace, or Zen Center. But they always go back to be families and workers of various kinds. So on the weekend, there were doctors and lawyers and social workers and all kinds of people who had serious big jobs, but take time out to practice. And who want to teach. So the teaching is the other element of it, that it's preparing to be able to serve in the way of doing a service like this, or a funeral, or a wedding, or a baby blessing, or a house blessing, or whatever anybody would need. So it's kind of a delightful life in a way. It's a lot of hard work, too. So that's the program. And once I learn more about it, I'll let you know. It's all new for me.
Well, I'm going to read out a very, very nice article on the website that talks about the tradition and the intention of this program. I just Googled spot. Amazing, the computer thing.
It's the Shogaku Institute. After Shunryu Shogaku. So, we're in the Diamond Sutra, just barely. I'll keep one for myself. Pass them around. So this is section 3. Which is very short. Britt, do you want to read it?
However many beings there are, in whatever realms of being might exist, whether they are born from an egg or born from a womb, born from the water or born from the air, whether they have form or no form, whether they have perception or no perception, or neither perception nor no perception, in whatever conceivable realm of being one might conceive of being, in the realm of complete nirvana, I shall liberate them all. And though I thus liberate countless beings, not a single being is liberated. And why not? Subhuti, a bodhisattva who creates the perception of a being, cannot be called a bodhisattva. And why not? Subhuti, no one can be called a bodhisattva who creates the perception of a self, or who creates the perception of a being, a life, or a soul.
So this is really the essence of the whole teaching. And it's repeated over and over all through this little sutra about the self. That creating a perception of a self, creating a perception of a being, a life, or a soul. When I was in Albuquerque a couple of weeks ago, I talked about the Bodhisattva vows, and I brought them, not all the different versions of them, including the one of Koban, which I kept for last, which is, not beings are numberless, I vow to save them, but beings are numberless, they will save themselves. And I think he's bringing up this side of it and reflecting this side, that you can't go out and save people. You can't see someone in that way. It's a false view. And that's what Buddha is saying here. So Subhuti, Buddha is answering all through this Subhuti's question, which in this case is, how should a noble son or daughter, we're all noble sons and daughters, aren't we? How should they set forth on the bodhisattva path? How should they stand? How should they walk? And how should they control their thoughts? And this is his first answer. So, I took these notes last week. So they're different translations. That last little bit is about Thich Nhat Hanh's translation, creates a perception of self, person, being, and lifespan. There are different ways of parsing it. Cherishes the idea of ego, personality, being, individual. and red pine creates the perception of a self, or who creates the perception of a being, a life, or a soul. So how are you then with beings? You can't not be someone, and you can't not be with others, but you can be as the perfection of wisdom says, unbiased, as you are with each thing, without judgment. Begin without judgment. Judgment's very important. We have to be extremely discriminating, distinguish carefully where we are and who we are. But if we're biased in our encounters, then we're living in a dream, because we can't see through our judgment. We've already created a solid thought that's in the way of seeing what's actually existing there. So one of the most important things is to simply allow oneself to be present and in the presence of what's actually facing us. And then, of course, we begin to know what to do, or not know, but feel what to do, and be the whole thing unrolls in a much easier way than trying to figure it all out, especially if we think we know it in the first place. So in the perfection of wisdom, toward all beings, maintain unbiased thoughts and speak unbiased words. Toward all beings, give birth to thoughts and words of kindness instead of anger, compassion instead of harm, joy instead of jealousy, equanimity instead of prejudice, humility instead of arrogance, sincerity instead of deceit, compromise instead of stubbornness, assistance instead of avoidance, liberation instead of obstruction, kinship instead of animosity. It sounds like a big order, but that's because it's all written down in one place, and it sounds like a big deal. But moment by moment, it's not such a big deal. It's just this, and this. And I like the kinship instead of animosity. I think that's really nice. We're all in this soup together, from beginning to end. So the Bodhisattva's job is to give the gift of liberation to all beings by giving birth to the thought of their liberation, thus using a thought to end thought. They use their thoughts as offerings. So Bodhisattvas see Buddha wherever they look. And this question about her question, it's just the idea of nirvana, the realm of complete nirvana, is an ancient term that means in the Theravadin tradition being burned out, that the fire has gone out, that there's nothing left. But in the Mahayana tradition, that has become more about extinguishing the things that get in our way moment by moment, and that this tough, hard-edged, ugly world that is so difficult to live in is nirvana itself. And with the eyes of kindness, with the eyes of compassion and joy and equanimity, we can see nirvana in samsara, nirvana in the difficult straits that we're living in, that we are. So he is assuming that beings are in every possible kind of situation, including in nirvana. And that Buddha says, I shall liberate them all. That's what the Bodhisattva should say, does say. Whoever they are, whether they're in eggs or wombs, let's see the Buddha side of things as well. Or the absolute side, or the, sometimes we say absolute relative. So everything in the samsara world is relative to everything else. High is relative to low. Low is relative to high, war to peace. In the absolute world, it's all of a piece, all one piece. That's what that form and emptiness thing is about. In form, it seems like it's all form, but form is informed. It's completely at one with all forms. And that itself is emptiness. That at oneness with form. It's not that form becomes emptiness or emptiness turns into form. We have to do something to wrench it into shape in some way. It's just that the whole thing is happening as we see and as we feel. In our meditation practice, we begin to feel how utterly interconnected we are. And so even as a formed thing, in the world of formed things, the whole thing is a living body. Living and breathing. Everything together. So that's what Subhuti is trying to discover. How to live this. How to live this truth. So creating a perception of self isn't the same as being a self. We all have to be somebody. But if we create a head on top of our head, which is an old Zen phrase, then we find ourselves parading ourselves around and being someone on top of just being. So we have time for a few questions. Sally?
I'm wondering if it's a matter of translation or if the world of plants and trees and things are excluded. It talks about things coming from eggs and the womb and the water and air.
Well, in the early days of Buddhism, it excluded everything except born from eggs, and that sentient being was something that breathed. In fact, in Sanskrit, the word for is, the verb is to breathe. There's the same word. But as Buddhism matured through time, it changed. And in China, it became all beings have Buddha nature, meaning all living things that we assume are living. So this is much earlier than that. And by the time Dogen went to China, he he came back from China teaching that all beings are Buddha nature. You don't have it or get it or something. It's what we are. So it's evolved over time as we mature, I think.
A little confirmation. I'm sure I've asked this before, but the idea of self in Western psychology and self-help and personal transformation, we do a lot of work on the self. But essentially, it's back to Dogen's statement of to study the self is to study the way. So is it's not so much that it seems to me that you know, I might be stating the obvious, but that the dissolution or the dissolving the self is really when we come to know the self in terms of realizing ourself is, or we're no different, or there is no separation, or that it's not myself, but it is it's knowing my thoughts is knowing all thoughts. Saying this well, but still, this self. I'm still trying to reconcile. I know innately that it supports each other, but of working with the self, knowing the self. For instance, work that I do with soul collage or shadow, or all of this. I mean, it is about my personal self, but the more that I understand my own personal self, or the longer that I sit, it doesn't seem to be so much about the personal self as much as it is about human nature.
Yeah.
So I'm just...
Yeah, so that by the time you get to that point, you don't have to dissolve the self. You see that the self you used to think was a solid, real thing isn't a solid, real thing at all. When we talk about getting rid of the ego, it's absurd because there isn't any. There's just what's happening. There's just the actions that we commit. That there's just the way that we are enacting our conditioning and our genetic background and where we came from in culture and all of it. We're so complicated. If we ever tried to take it all apart and see who we are, it would be huge, much huger than we think of ourselves. So when we begin to study the self, as Dogen said, to study Buddhism is to study the self, to sit down and try to find the self inside yourself. That all by itself is a very interesting exercise. Where is it? Is it in my belly? Is it in my heart? Is it in my guts? My little finger? That's where it is, right there. So you begin to look, and also, you know, therapy is very helpful, especially helpful, I would say, to really begin to see how this whole thing is working. It's a very dynamic form, feeling, perception, impulses, consciousness. All of those put together in time and space, and we say, it's me. And we get in trouble when we get so attached to that me, some little, teeny little aspect of that me, you know, where I graduated and what I do and how much money I make and that I like the color yellow and blah, blah, blah. And like, that's me. But me is so much more than that. So much. And if we allow freedom for me, then there isn't a stuck self somewhere. That's what it's really about.
I just get tripped around sometimes.
Yeah.
Form and emptiness, and then sometimes I think there. That's probably the problem right there. But when I do personal transformation, working with that and with other people, I sometimes think, well, why am I even doing that? We're striving for this no self. You know, it's
not a thing.
It's not a logical. It's not a yeah, right.
It's not a thing to get.
Just thank you. I just always need that validation.
It's tricky. It's very tricky. It's,
well, I always remember, you're always telling me, well, you can't have, but I think especially Eckhart Tolle, a lot of people hooked on to that.
Yes.
You know, ego, no ego is, you know, bad.
And yes.
So many, you know, many of my clients go, oh, I shouldn't have an ego. Well, teacher says
we've
got to have
the
egos to dissolve it.
So but you don't even need to dissolve it.
Yeah, exactly. It's like
you forget it.
Yeah. Or
that's what Dogen says.
There.
Okay. Dogen says to study Buddhism is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. And having forgotten the self, you can be enlightened by anything. That's where enlightenment is. After you've gotten out of your own way, it's not that there's some big, glorious, golden thing that happens. It's just that you step aside so that the whole thing can, the dynamic that is already here, can happen.
I'm preparing for a weekend retreat, and I'm thinking. Mm-hmm.
Well, you have to.
How do you articulate these, you know, these nice little, you know, this active imagination? How does that work? Well, you know, another term, you know, it's another word for, you know, this and that. It's just so interesting how, again, Western psychology and how we all have all these, you know, words.
It's more helpful in those kinds of situations just to set them loose and see what happens. Because you know what a surprise it always is. Yes, yeah, something mysterious just shines right back from that kind of work. Yeah. Good luck.
Yeah.
Well, it's 8:00.